Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Coach Cricket Show. I'm David Hinchliffe, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. Got a special guest for you today, a new presenter for the show called Kevin. Kevin Sampath, is that right, Kevin?
Yeah, that's right. Excellent. There, guys.
How are you doing, Kevin? All right?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you, David?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Yeah. So, Kevin, just for the benefit of people who haven't heard you before, can you tell us a little bit about you and where you are and your cricket experience?
Yeah. So, well, as you've heard, my name is Kevin Sampath, and currently I'm 18 years old. And I was originally born in India, but lived about 11 years of my life in the United Arab Emirates, which is where the Sharjah Cricket Stadium is. And In 2001, I moved to Australia, which is cricket crazy, basically. And at the moment, I'm a fast medium bowler and a lower order batsman, though I'd like to make it up the order soon with a bit of work. And I'm playing B-grade cricket here in Australia, which is a bit of a mix of people who just want to have fun and a mix of people who are a bit serious about their cricket. And I've done a bit of coaching with the younger people at school, so sort of coached them and done a bit of work with the kids kids in my team at school as well.
So B-grade cricket is probably similar to what we would think about in the UK as sort of maybe second or third 11 type club cricket, I would imagine. Is that right?
Yeah, basically how the system works here is the elite level is sort of the state teams, like the county teams in England. And below that is the first grade teams from different districts, which is sort of the step down from straight, which is where most of the players for state get picked from. And below first grade, there are many different other grades. That is in the district itself. And then below that, there's grades in the suburbs. And those grades get divided into A grade, B grade, and C grade. And A grade is sort of the team you need to make it into to make it up to the teams where you get noticed for playing for state. And B and C grade is more social. And if you're in there, you're going to try and make it to A grade as much as you can.
How big is a district? Like the district you're in, what big an area does that cover?
I'd say there's about 14 different suburbs, as in 14 different teams in under a district. And from there, they have to pick a top 11. I see top probably about 60 players to represent their six different grades. And from there, they get picked for state.
You've got 60 which are playing at first grade level.
Yeah.
For a district, roughly speaking.
Yeah.
And 60 to 70, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that's being picked from how many teams? Did you say 14?
Yeah, 14 in each district. So there's about more than 50 districts in New South Wales itself. So there'd be so many players to pick from. That's why there's a lot of different grades where there's people just having fun and people wanting to get serious about their cricket.
Yeah, okay. So that's quite a lot of cricket being played. For someone in the UK, that's quite a big difference, I'd say. You've come from another country, so you probably know it more than others. Just how much does cricket dominate in Australia, would you say?
I say in summer, it is the dominant sport. Like, you can't see people playing anything else. It's just cricket, and more cricket. And it's not even a sport itself. It's like a pastime or hobby. Everywhere you turn around, there's people playing cricket, even if it's not seriously, but they're playing in the parks. And most winter sports are based around cricket as well. Like, there's a sport invented here called AFL, which is big here, and was basically invented to keep the cricketers fit during winter. So it's pretty serious down here.
Okay, so it's the sport, in other words.
Yeah,
it's certainly in the summer. Yeah.
Yeah, true.
So if you're in Australia then and you are trying to make it into professional cricket, how do you make your way up the grades then? Are there people scouting you, or do you have to go to trials, or how does that work?
Basically, you have to get noticed by statistics. So there'd be coaches in different grades looking through different statistics of different grade teams. And if your statistics are good, say your batting average is good or your bowling economy and strike rate are good, then they'll call you in for a trial and they'll want to have a look at you, or they'll come to your games and have a look at you. So it's basically you have to work hard in the team you're in and try to work up the team. So, because if you're in C grade, you won't really get much of a look in. But maybe the higher teams in B grade and A grade, you'd get a look in to be in one of the district grades and possibly even New South Wales.
And you can move up pretty quickly. There's a lot of stories of people who have gone from very low down or relatively low down to playing state and even test level very quickly.
Yeah, there are a lot of fairy tale stories. People in the lower grades here get noticed by scouts from even the UK, even, and scouts from India and all over the world. So it's really about working hard at your game and getting noticed.
I think that's the same pretty much everywhere you go. The important thing is to work hard on your game and do everything you can to get noticed. When I wrote an article on this, which is one of the more popular articles on the My Coach site, at pitchvision.com, one of the things that I wrote is that it doesn't really matter where you are. You have to do certain things to get noticed. And of course, one of those is to get the runs or get the wickets. But on top of that, you have to practice all the time. You have to sort of push your case as much as you can. You can't just sit back and wait for people to find you. You have to try and find ways to push your own case. It's good to have a mentor, somebody who's done it perhaps, and who you can rely on to help you out. It's good to have support, social support from people, other people who are also trying to do the same thing. And it's absolutely critical to be very, very strong mentally. And I think you have to work on your mental game as much as you do on the technical side of your game. And that those things together, putting all those things together, I don't think it makes any difference whether you will live in India, whether you live in Australia, or you live in England. It's the same for everybody in that way. It's just that the system is slightly different depending on where you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like in the UK, we have club cricket, we have Premier League club cricket, which is more like a patchwork system than the grade system in Australia, from the sounds of it. And then, if you do well in Premier League cricket, then it's a lot more difficult to move from Premier League cricket into professional county cricket, because the two systems don't mesh together perfectly. But that's where the academy system comes in this country, which
Yeah.
has been copied quite a lot from Australia. But the academy system to take people for sort of teenage kind of age, at the age of around about 16, and then they take them on as almost as full-time professionals from the age of 60. Not quite, but they come under the wing of a county pretty much straight away, which is slightly different, I think, from the Australian system, where you play grade cricket first, and in fact you get international and national level players going back into first grade cricket, don't for games, don't they? You find that quite a lot more. Yeah, you rarely find, say, a first class cricketer in the UK playing club cricket. So I think that's the difference. But that's a difference in systems rather than a difference in what you need to do to make it, I think.
The success of Australian cricket is due to the fact that a lot of international players go back to play grade cricket, and players who just started playing grade cricket get a lot more exposure to international ability. And they feel the need to improve against those kind of players, which is why you see a lot of up and coming youngsters in Australian cricket especially.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you can't help but get you can't help but get better if you're bowling against a test level player, can you? Or batting against a test level bowler, you can't help but get better. Yeah, can you? And also, of course, if you're playing in the same team as somebody who's at that level, you can sort of you can sort of get an idea of what you need to do to get to that level yourself. You can read more on for those listening, you can read more on the Pitch Vision site about becoming a professional cricketer. I'll put a link in the show notes to that particular article. So if you go to pitchvision.com/mycoach, you'll be able to go to that article. Or if you prefer to look for it yourself, if you go onto Google and type in how to become a professional cricketer, it should come up as one of the top results on Google. That's the difference between the grade system in Australia and the the club system in the UK. And if anyone has any comments on that or wants to give their own feedback about their experience in either of the systems or wants some more advice on either of the systems, then you can get in touch with myself or Kevin through the MyCoach email address, which is mycoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycoach@pitchvision.com. You can also go to pitchvision.com/contact, and there's a form there that you can fill in to get in touch with us that way. Okay, so moving on to the next section, we got some readers' questions. So I want to go through those now, and Kevin's going to help me out with those. Thank you very much, Kevin.
No problems.
And let's start with a technical question. Now, I'm not sure who this is from. It's from an anonymous emailer. I won't give out their email address, but it's JT. So JT, if you're listening, I hope you you recognize your question. Here's the question. Hi, I was wondering if you can help me with my batting. I'm a left-hander and I bat on or outside leg stump. I'm comfortable playing balls on or outside off stump and I'm good off my pads, but when they're on middle or middle and leg, I try to step forward and I often get bowled between bat and pad. Just wondering if you have any tips for me. So if I open up Kevin first, see,
yep.
Let me know what you think of that one there. So he's left-handed,
sure.
But he's getting bowled through the gate quite a lot. So what do you think about that one, Kevin?
Basically, after watching a lot of left-handers, I'd have to say probably maybe the stance. So maybe his stance is a bit too wide open and maybe pointing towards the leg side too much. So, because I've heard he plays off his pads very well. So maybe having trouble get from the in-swinging balls through his stance, and maybe he's opening up a bit too much. So probably correcting that a bit and making it more sort of straight. I think watching Matthew Hayden a lot should help him, because he negates the swing a lot especially. So he gets to the pitch of the ball and doesn't let the bowler get too much swing in to make him struggle. And Gilchrist, after the shocking batting form in the Ashes of 2005, where he was getting bowled a lot by Flintoff and all that, he started getting to the pitch of a bowler a lot more, and he succeeded through that.
Yeah, it's very hard for us to tell without actually seeing JT batting. But yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, being able to get to the pitch of the ball, a common thing with left-handers, it's almost a cliche to say it, is that they tend to play from the crease a lot more than right-handers, because they find the ball slanting across them more often, because more often they're facing right hand over the wicket bowling. The ball slanting across them, you don't need to move your feet as much to be able to drive necessarily.
Yeah.
So especially if the ball's swinging back into the left-hander, which a lot of right-hand bowlers can do because they're natural away swing bowlers to right-handers, so it's a natural in-swing to a left-hander. If you're not moving your feet very much, you might find your head in the wrong position, your head and your front shoulder in the wrong position when the ball pitches. And if, as you say, if it's swinging, then you've got a problem. If the ball's not swinging and you're still getting bowled through the gate, then it might still be to do with head position. He's saying he bats outside leg stump sometimes. That's quite a long way over, even for a left-hander. As you were saying, he may be open with his stance.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm assuming JT is male. I've got no way of knowing that for sure. We're assuming JT's male. If his head is staying quite a long way over to the leg side, and again, this would show itself with poor footwork.
Yeah.
Then he would find himself struggling to play the ball if it's swinging back into him.
Yeah.
Or balls that are on the off stump.
Yeah.
Because it's quite hard to judge. It's quite hard to judge where your off stump is if you're quite a long way across to the leg side. The other thing I would want to look at would be, what is his head doing at the point of delivery?
Yeah.
Because if he is batting quite a long way outside the leg stump and he's moving back and across as a trigger movement, which a lot of batsmen do, then he may still be moving his head at the point of delivery.
Yeah.
Now, it's hard enough to track the ball coming towards you at whatever 80 miles an hour, whatever it's coming towards you at, when your head is still. If you add in the extra complexity of having to track from left to right with your eyes because your head's still moving, then you would struggle then, I think, to be able to play the straighter ones. So if that's happening, obviously we can't see JT, so it's hard to say. But if that's happening, if his head's still moving,
yeah.
If he's got a trigger movement and his head's still moving, then the advice I'd give, and this is the advice I give for anyone with any batting problem, make sure your head is still. I don't care what your trigger movement is. You can do anything you like. You can jump up and down on one leg if you want. As long as you're still at the point of delivery, that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend jumping up and down on one leg, though. That's not a good trigger movement. okay, so moving on. I've had a couple of fitness-related questions, and they're quite similar in their style, although one's for a batsman and one's for a bowler. So I'll go through those now. One's from Jack from the UK, and one is from Matt, I think it is. The email address says Matt_Ben, so it could be either or both. I don't know. So let's call him Matt. Sorry if your name's Ben. We'll call him Matt. Here are the questions. Hello, I came across your website after searching for cricket bowling speed training. I'm 18 years old and I've just finished my cricket season. I'm an opening bowler. By the way, it's the end of the season here in the UK, and presumably you're just coming into your season now, are you?
Yeah, we're just about to start.
So when is the first game for you?
First game for us is next week, so can't wait.
Okay. Oh God. Yeah, I love this time of the season. You know, early season is excellent. It's not quite the same in the UK when it's freezing in the spring in the UK, but you have to put on a couple of extra jumpers. But at least you're out there. Okay. So anyway, back to the question. I'm an opening bowler and taking 39 wickets this season, which is not too bad at all. My opening partner is a Royal Marine and is a lot stronger than me. He generates a lot of pace in his bowling, which means he can bowl very economical overs, as many batsmen find it hard to face fast bowling. I've been trying for a couple of weeks now to put together a training program that will allow me to increase my bowling speed for next season. I saw a link at the end of the page that stated that you can put together a personal program for me. I'll be very grateful for any response, as I'm eager to start training straight away. A yearly plan would be very much appreciated. Now, that's a lot of work in putting together a yearly plan for an individual. So I'm not going to do that. But what I am going to do is I'm going to give some tips on how you can build your own yearly plan, Jack. Okay, so the question from Matt is very similar. After a long summer of matches and net sessions, the season is coming to a close, and as a relatively skinny 16-year-old who wants to bulk up during the off-season, as well as trying to maintain my batting during the winter, I was wondering what I could do to keep myself going. My technique is very good, however, I feel that my lack of power and strength has been one of the instrumental reasons for being out several times this season whilst trying to go slightly more aggressive, which is a contrast to my quite conservative game, which I'm so used to playing. Is there any chance you could design a training program which could benefit me over the off season, which will pay dividends in the long term? So again, it's a similar problem, although it's two different skills. I don't feel like I'm getting the best from myself because I'm not strong and powerful enough. So I'm going to give a few tips on that now. Just before I do that, I just want to put a couple of provisos in. You have to remember that cricket, although cricket is a game based largely on skill, it's still mainly a power sport. So if you're training, you should really be training for power rather than saying trying to bulk up or anything like that. I mean, just because big muscles don't necessarily mean big power. So that's a big difference there. But also, do remember that cricket is primarily a game based on skill. Fast bowling is about generating as much pace as possible by having long levers and a fast action. And batting is about timing. So you don't need to be massively strong and powerful to be able to do either of those things. I mean, if you look at if you look at some of the greatest batsmen in history and some of the greatest bowlers as well, they're not huge behemoths, you know, like you'd see in the World's Strongest Man competition. Although they tend to be very athletic, you don't necessarily see. So it's not necessarily just a matter of bulking up or a matter of getting strong for the sake of very strong. So we do want to cover that. We do want to cover that off before we go into the program itself. Okay, so onto the fitness program itself. Yes, it's a very good idea to train for fitness. It helps prevent injury and it will increase your ability to perform your skills, both reducing fatigue so you can perform those skills for longer and also increasing your speed that you can play shots that you can run and you can bowl at. So it's a very good thing to do. So the first question is, what's the goal of the training program? Now, for most people, it will be more power, more speed, because those are the two key elements when you're talking about fitness. And also related to that is an increased ability to generate power and to generate speed. Now, in the olden days, that used to be called endurance, and you used to have to run for miles and miles and miles to be able to do that. That's pretty much gone by the wayside now, and we call it work capacity now. You still hear people say endurance or stamina. It all means the same thing. It's just slightly different way of describing it, because we want to get away from the idea of running for miles and miles, kilometers and kilometers, to be able to get fitter. But we're talking about mainly speed and power here. So the next question is, what kind of experience do you have? This will vary greatly depending on how old you are and what sort of training you've done in the past, and what sort of coaching you've had, fitness coaching you've had, because it can vary wildly. Some people will have had, been taught how to do correct weightlifting from the age of, 15 or 16. Some people will have never done anything apart from a few press-ups in their sort of physical education lessons. It can vary wildly. So that your starting point then massively changes what your training program is going to look like, because if you know how to do Olympic lifting, like if you've seen in the Olympics recently, you've seen them do the clean and jerks, the snatches and those kind of things, those are great exercises, and I would recommend any cricketer to be able to do those exercises. But they also take quite a lot of time to learn, especially to learn how to do them with heavy weight, which is really what you want to be doing, your relatively heavy weight with them. You don't want to go and try and learn them yourself. You want someone to be able to teach you how to do them correctly, because otherwise you're going to injure yourself. So if I've got someone who I'm recommending a training program to, and they know how to do cleans, and they know how to do snatches, and they know how to do high pulls, and they know how to do a lot of different Olympic style lifts, then I would put those into their program without a shadow of a doubt, without hesitation. Also, if they've got access to a coach who can teach them those things, then again, I will put those into the program, but I would put in maybe a 2 or 3 week period where they learn how to do those lifts before they move on to actually lifting a decent amount of weight. The next question is, what equipment have you got? Some people, especially people who are teenagers, you tend to find they haven't necessarily got access to a lot of equipment. They might be a little bit worried about going to a gym, or may not have the money to be able to go to a gym. They might have some dumbbells or something, which they've got for a present or something like that. But they can only really train with body weight training, just using the resistance of your own body, like press ups and chin ups and things like that. At the other end of the scale, you've got people with access to a full gym. My gym that's just around the corner from me has got pretty much everything you could possibly need for training in, and obviously then I can say to somebody who's going to a gym like I go to, great, let's do squats, let's do deadlifts, let's do different exercises, depending on what equipment is available. If you've got access to Olympic weight set, you're going to be able to do a lot more than if you've just got access to a tree for doing chin-ups on, and a field which is just around the corner from your house.
Yeah.
So my next question would always be, what equipment have we got available to us? Because that, again, will massively vary what's going on. The next question is, how much time have you got available? I tend to find, as a general rule, that people who are just starting training programs think they've got more time to train than they actually have.
Yeah.
And I find that people who have been training for a little while probably could do a little bit more training than they think they've got time to do. So generally speaking, you want to be able to train at least twice a week. This is fitness training only now. You want to be training at least twice a week, but once a week is better than no times a week. The gold standard, the sort of professional level, if you like, is 4 times a week. But even at that level, you tend to find that professional cricketers, even the ones who do it for a living, you probably find they're doing strength training 2 or 3 times a week. So It's not only the number of training sessions you can do in a week, it's also how much time you can spend doing training. Some people might only have half an hour to get into the gym and get out again. I would say half an hour is probably the minimum that you want to be training for, because otherwise you can't get everything in that you want to get in.
Mm-hmm.
At the other end of the scale, I probably wouldn't want to do any kind of strength training for more than an hour, because after an hour, your body tends to start giving up the levels of cortisol lift, which is a hormone which is a regulating hormone in your body, start to go up dramatically, and you tend to lose any benefits of training over an hour. So the ideal again would be sort of 45 minutes to an hour to train, and then some people maybe they've only got half an hour. If you can only manage 15 minutes, again that's better than 0 minutes. But once you get below about 15 minutes, you are starting to struggle to get any gains at all, either with strength or speed or power or endurance or work capacity. So you really want to have at least half an hour there. So how much you've got available to train and how much time you've got available per week would be the next question. The third question, well, that's not the third question, actually. It's probably about the fifth question. But anyway, the next question is, how long have you got to train like this? Now, that's an important question. That's to do with something called periodization, which is your ability to plan throughout the year what you're going to do. Cricket being a seasonal sport for most people, unless you're very lucky to live in a country where you can play competitive cricket all year round, or you're playing at a high enough level where you've got to play all year round. Cricket fits neatly into the periodised model of having a off-season, a pre-season, and an in-season training period. Those periods will differ dramatically as to what you're going to be doing. In-season, you don't want to be tiring yourself out by training every day, by strength training every day. In the off-season, because you're not playing cricket, you might be playing another sport, you might be playing football or rugby or something like that, but if cricket is your main sport and you're not playing it, then you can concentrate more on building up your strength, your power, your speed, and any other aspect that you want to develop during that time. So you'd be training harder in the off-season. So the question is, how long is that off-season going to be before you start training again? In the UK, around where I am, our season is only from the end of April until the end of August. So that's a relatively short season. So we've got a relatively long... In other parts of the country, you find teams playing all the way through April to the end of September. I don't know what it's like in Australia. Maybe you can tell me, Kevin, what's the season like for you? How long does it last?
It lasts from about September to about March next year, so not entirely, I don't know, about 6 months, roughly.
Okay, so September, October, November, December, January, February, March, yeah, so 7 months, roughly speaking. So that's quite long, so there'll be a relatively shorter off-season where you're focusing on certain things, and a relatively shorter pre-season where you're focusing on slightly different things. So how long your off-season will make a difference to what sort of training you're doing and how often you change your training program. Okay, so bearing all those questions in mind, once you've got the answer to those questions, you should have a basic structure of what you're going to be doing. Let's say, for example, in the off-season, you can train 3 times a week for 45 minutes per session, and you've got access to a gym, just to pick an example. In the season, you might decide to train, okay, because I'm playing cricket and I'm practicing a couple of times a week, I don't want to tire myself out with too much fitness work, so where you change that down to twice a week for half an hour and just kind of maintain the gains that I got in the off season. Some people, I tried this year an experiment with actually trying to make gains during the season, and that worked pretty well for me. We had some good progress with getting people to improve their fitness in season by focusing on one specific element. So early in the season we focused on building up work capacity, late in the season we focused on building up strength, and we did make some slight gains in both of those areas. But also, when we were building up strength, for example, towards the end of the season, the second half of the season, we did lose out on work capacity, on endurance, as we were training that hardly at all. So you've got to strike a balance, and you will always lose out a little bit in season because you haven't got time to do everything. Otherwise, you'd just be exhausted trying to play cricket. So what kind of things should you be focusing on? What kind of actual exercises? Well, cricket is, as I said before, is not a sport where you want to be bulky. It's something that a lot of people fear. You know, if they go to the gym, if they start doing chin-ups, they'll suddenly turn into the Incredible Hulk. That's not going to happen. The guys you see in the gym with the big bodybuilder physiques, they train in a certain way. A lot of them take steroids, and whether they take steroids or not, they eat a huge amount of food. And that makes a big difference to the size of the muscles. We're not interested necessarily in the size of the muscle. We're interested in how well that muscle performs. There's clearly a relationship between the two. If you get stronger, you're going to get bigger muscles, but you aren't necessarily going to get massive muscles, and we don't really want that. We want to muscles. So you're looking towards power-based stuff, which the trainer, the famous trainer Alwyn Cosgrove, he's a Scottish guy, but he lives in America now, and he's very successful at sports performance. He calls it elastic training, or stretch shortening cycle training, which is just a physiological term for what happens when you're jumping or running or throwing. It's that elastic type, those elastic type movements where your muscles elongate and then they shorten again very quickly in order to, say, throw or bowl. So you want to be focusing on that kind of stuff. It's a lot of it is to do with timing. You know, a lot of cricket is to do with timing, you know, to coordinating your muscles in a certain order to be able to get the maximum out of them, especially if you're talking about bowling, fast bowling in particular. How well you coordinate every single muscle in your body will make a significant difference to the speed gun of what's coming out of your hand. So if you're poorly coordinated, you're not going to be particularly fast at bowling. And also, if you're poorly coordinated, you're not going to be so good with timing the cricket shots. So the exercises that you do should be exercises that focus on coordination, on balance, on explosive power, and on stabilizing your body, especially the center of your body, the core, which is where the power is transferred around the hips and the back and the shoulders and that kind of region, the middle of your body, if you like. That's sometimes we call it the core. That's an important part, although you shouldn't train the core in isolation. So what are you looking at for stuff like that? You're looking at movements, pushing movements, pulling movements that allow you to stand on the ground and work in three dimensions. So you don't want to be looking at machines to be doing these things, because machines usually have you sitting down, and machines isolate muscles. So if you imagine you're sitting down on a shoulder press machine, you're pressing the weight up and down, and you're lifting up a weight, and you're thinking, great, this is exercising my shoulders. Yes, it is. But how is that going to translate to what you're doing on the cricket pitch? I would say not very much. Or certainly not as much as even if you're doing the same exercises with a couple of dumbbells standing up. Even that is more beneficial than doing it sitting down on a machine, because you're having to use all your muscles to stabilize your body as you're doing it. Other stuff you can do, as I said before, cleans, snatches, things like that. Anything that is multi-joint. So you're talking about things like deadlifts, squats, stuff like that. Work with a medicine ball is excellent, because a medicine ball teaches you how to transfer power through your body. If you're throwing a medicine ball against the wall, then that's excellent. So is martial arts, because again, with a punch or a kick, you're learning how to transfer weight through your body. And transfer of weight is one of those things that you hear people talk about on the television a lot. Transfer of weight from the back foot to the front foot when you're batting or bowling, quickly, a key element to success. Also, exercises which allow you to coordinate yourself and balance yourself. So anything you do on one leg, anything where you do more than one movement during the exercise, sometimes they call those movements complexes. anything along those lines will also improve your cricket, I feel. And anything which is using your body in three dimensions. Because if you're using your body in three dimensions, you're learning how to balance, you're learning how to coordinate. So what I'd say is find some exercises like that, and then fit those exercises into the key questions that I was talking about before. How much time you've got, how much equipment you've got, what your experience is, and how long your off season is. So I hope that answers the question. That's about as comprehensive as I can get in a few minutes. I don't know if you've got anything to add, Kevin. I know it's not your specialist area, but I don't know if you've got anything to add to that, have you?
Yeah, it's not my specialist area, as you say, but I really, after listening to your last cricket show talk with Ian Pont, I really think that the technical side of cricket is absolutely more important, because you can get strong, you can get powerful, but it's no use without being technical and without analysing your run-up, your bowling action, your follow-through and everything else. You can't get successful without all of that, so as much as your strength and power, you should concentrate on those areas as well.
Absolutely. If there's one piece of advice that I wouldn't agree more with on your that I couldn't agree more with, it's skill is the number one element that we're talking about here. Skill, if you imagine it to be a little bit like a pyramid, though, the way I think of it is that you've got the ability to move, to just do basic human movements like walk, bend down, pull things, push things. Those are basic movements. That's nothing to do with strength. It's just your ability to move is the bottom of the pyramid. The second part of the pyramid is strength, but the top of the pyramid, the most important part, is skill. And you should always be working on skill first. And even when you're in the gym or doing fitness work, you should be asking yourself, how is this going to be directly improving my cricket? Because doing a few bicep curls might be good for the beach, and the girls might like it, but it's not going to help your cricket doing bicep curls. So the question should be, how is this going to help my skill levels? And that should always be your number one question. So yeah, I agree with you completely on that. Okay, so we've got one more question. I think we've got time for one more question, and I think we'll probably wrap it up. It's a question which I've been meaning to answer for quite a while. So let me apologise to my friend. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce his name, but I think it's Dhruv, Dhruv. Ever heard that name before?
Yeah,
That's
Drew should be right.
Dhruv, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He asked me a long time ago a question about nutrition, and it's a practical question in that he's still at school, and he takes a packed lunch into school.
Yeah.
Now he's followed the. He's trying to follow the 10 rules of cricket nutrition that I've got up on the website,
Yeah.
And I'll put a link up in the show notes to that so we know what's going on there. But he's trying to follow those rules, but he's got a problem because he can't take any meat into his school. It's one of the rules of his school. His school doesn't permit non-veg, so he's got to be vegetarian in what he eats. So how can he take something in with his packed lunch that will last all day, it'll give him lots of protein and lots of energy, and still follow the rules of cricket nutrition as outlined by John Berardi. So the obvious answer I would have to that is that if you want to get some protein and you can't get it from any other source, then probably the best way to do it is to have some nuts and seeds, because they will give you plenty of protein, and also they're very good for you for other reasons, because they contain healthy fats as well. So I would say, go for some nuts, go for some seeds, and see if you can get something in that way. If you're allowed to do this, then you might want to think about some kind of protein shake of some kind or other. Some people are against that. Some people don't mind that. It's purely on a personal preference. I wouldn't mind having one myself. If you do go for one like that, then go for one which gives you plenty of protein, and you don't want any carbohydrates in there if you can, if you're having that in the middle of the day. The exception would be if you've done some training in the middle of the day, which I assume you wouldn't if you're at school, but if you've done some training in the middle of the day, then you could probably get away with having some carbohydrates, a sandwich or something afterwards, after that. But I certainly wouldn't recommend it for just in the middle of the day of a normal day. Also, you do want to try and get some veg in there. So, if you've got you know, if you can get an ice pack, it's something that you can throw it in the freezer at the end of the day when you get home from school, and then put it into your lunchbox when you're leaving for school. Then, you know, chop up a few vegetables and just have some vegetables that you can snack on there. What I eat all the time is carrots, a cucumber, bell peppers. Those are the three things that keep me going when I'm out and about, and I'm not able to have sort of proper veg.
Yeah.
So that'd be my advice there. There's also dairy options. You know, cheese is a reasonable option. As long as it's sugar-free yogurt, that's a good option. So do the best you can. Look for stuff that's high in protein and low in carbohydrate, low in sugars for that meal. Anything that you want to add to that one, Kevin?
Yeah, in terms of the protein powder, there's protein bars as well, which are relatively cheap, so they could be sort of a good addition. And carbohydrates, if Dhruv sounds like an Indian sort of subcontinental name, so our diets are sort of very high in carbohydrates, so we got to stay away from all of this stuff with our protein. So just keep it purely protein, lean protein, and all the carbohydrates should come with our diets.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, just so people know about the 10 rules of cricket nutrition, it's not a low carbohydrate diet as such that you would see like in Atkins or something like that.
Yeah.
It's the basic idea of it is that you have a low carbohydrate diet when you're trying to lose weight. But if you're training, which you should be if you're trying to lose weight, let's be honest, then you have some carbohydrates after you've trained. So you save up your carbohydrates like rice, potatoes, pasta, those kind of thing, until after you've trained. That's if you're trying to either lose or maintain the weight that you're currently at. When I say weight, I mean fat, really. The fat levels that you're currently at, but maintain the muscle levels that you're at. It works long term because you are getting carbohydrates in relatively regularly, and it's not a low carb diet like Atkins or something like that. It's a lower carb way of eating, which generally speaking, for most people, they can benefit from eating slightly less carbohydrates and getting more quality whole foods in. Not there's anything wrong with rice and pasta and stuff like that. It's good stuff. It's just the general principles of that way of eating. It's precision nutrition, it's called.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that's probably all we've got time for, because I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I know there's quite a big time difference between you and I, Kevin, so I don't want to be talking well into the night with you. So so that's going to wrap up the show for this time. If you've got any questions yourself, you can email in to mycoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycoach@pitchvision.com. Or you can go to pitchvision.com/contact and get in touch with us. And either myself or Kevin, or if we're lucky enough, guest, will hopefully be able to answer your questions to the best of our abilities. Bye.